as it learns the senses-shattering truth of how they stole Frasier's brain.
Oh, hey, look at you. You're early. I wasn't expecting you quite this soon. Give me just a second. I'll close up here. I've just been cleaning out the cloning chamber, and I'll close this. Okay. What was that? That's a long story. Basically, there's a place in town that makes turduckins. If you've ever heard of a turducken, it's like a chicken stuffed inside a duck, stuffed inside a turkey. They're supposedly really, really good. There's a place in town that makes them, and I've wanted one for several years for Thanksgiving dinner, but you know, they're expensive, and so I've never actually bought one from the place. But at the same time, you know, if I were to try to cook one myself, they're really, really labor-intensive. It's just a big pain in the butt. So what I decided to do, I came down to the secret lab here, and I grabbed the old DNA splicer, and I just dialed myself up one. You know, the DNA splicer down here, it's dead simple to work. When the professor built it, he the controls are actually a big CNC. You just turn the arrow to whatever animal you want to splice up, and then you pull the string, and you've added its DNA to the sequence. So, you know, I dialed myself a turkey, a duck, and a chicken, set the culture aside to cure for a couple of days, and then I was good to go. Unfortunately, after I put the culture in the cloning chamber and set it to forest grow so I would have a fully grown turducken in time for Thanksgiving, what I found out was that my daughter had snuck down here while the culture was still curing and made some additions. She had actually added an octopus because she likes the drumsticks and she wanted it to have more legs. So she dialed in an octopus, and then she saw a picture of a kitty, and she likes cats, and so she added a cat to the mix. So instead of a turducken, imagine my surprise when, after 2 days of forest growing, I found out that what I had was a fully grown turductopussy. And so I couldn't eat it. It has tentacles with feathers and claws, and it's a very sad looking creature. There was no way I was going to eat it, but I couldn't just, you know, kill it, so I've been keeping it in the cloning chamber. I need to get a proper cage for it, or maybe take it somewhere and set it free, but, you know, people are going to freak out. A turductopussy is not something that you normally, you know, see hanging around. Hi, I'm Tony Frasier, film critic, science fiction writer, and near genius. And it's been a pretty good week. I went to see Cloverfield, which was a fun little movie. Cloverfield, if you don't know, is kind of a mix of... It's like the ultimate high-concept picture. High-concept, if you weren't around during the 80s, is I think they call it an elevator pitch now. Basically, you describe the picture in one brief sentence, and if you can describe it by comparing it to two other things, it's even better. You know, Under Siege, the high concept of Under Siege was Die Hard on a boat. Cloverfield, the high concept, is Godzilla meets the Blair Witch Project, meets the OC, kind of. You have a bunch of 20-something people at a going-away party in New York, and this is like their home movies of the going-away party, and then a monster attacks New York, and the guy with the camera runs away with his friends, and we just basically see his home movies of trying to escape from this giant monster. It's a deceptively simple film. You know, it's all shot in point of view, and the effects are marvelous. I'm going to be talking more about it later, but the thing about it was, as I was thinking about it, you know, I'm thinking about this movie, and of course, what it immediately brings to mind is Godzilla, which, you know, Godzilla brought us the most famous sound effect, probably the most famous monster sound effect of all time, the most recognizable anyway. But more than that, a lot of people look at Godzilla as sort of the beginning of the genre. You know, the idea of the giant monster that attacks the city. Only, you know, Godzilla was part of a wave of movies in the 50s. Godzilla may have been the first one, or it may have been the one that spawned the most success. You know, there have been, how many Godzilla pictures have there been? 20? 30? Godzilla has, you know, just returns dependably over and over again. Plus, there have been a couple of TV series, a couple of Saturday morning TV series. One in the 80s, and one in the, well, late 70s or early 80s, and one in the 90s that was a series based on the American remake. The thing about Godzilla is that when Godzilla came out in the 50s, he was part of a, you know, there was an entire wave of American giant monster movies at the same time. Giant mantises and giant scorpions and giant ants and you know, Gorgo the sea monster, and there was just a whole a ton of them that came out at that time, and they were all kind of built around the same anxieties. You know, it was all science run amok, nuclear testing. You know, we don't know. I mean, it was all giant monsters as a metaphor for science unleashing things. Essentially, the Jurassic Park, the same thing that Jurassic Park was. We have these scientists who are discovering things faster than we can responsibly use them. I guess is the argument. But I don't know that that was really the origin of the genre, because I look back from there, you know, essentially the same plot line was used in the Arch Oboler radio drama on Lights Out, the Chicken Heart, the one that Bill Cosby did his famous comedy routine about. There was actually an actual radio show called The Chicken Heart, and in that, a scientist is experimenting on a chicken heart, and the experiment gets out of control, and the chicken heart starts growing and just absorbing everything around it. I found the thing. I had heard of it for years, and I read about it in Stephen King's excellent meditation on the horror genre, Danse Macabre. However you want to pronounce it. God, I hate foreign languages. Anyway, I finally found it on archive.org, the Internet Archive, in the old radio section. And what amazed me is it's only 7 minutes long. It's a beautiful piece of storytelling economy. If I wanted to, I could play you the whole thing here.
Yes, boring.
Bite me, Price. I'm sorry. I was talking about Vincent Price in the last in the last visit, and his ghost, for some reason, is still hanging around here. Anyway, where was I? The Chicken Heart. I could play the whole show for you if you wanted, but the thing about the Chicken Heart is it's really lacking a third act. The Chicken Heart grows and grows, and then it keeps growing, and everything that the humans try to do to stop it fails, and so it's the end of the world.
The end of mankind.
Why?
Because of a chicken's heart.
No! No, we won't die. I can't die. I'll find a safe landing somewhere. I'll find a place. The motor, it's cut out. We're in a spin. I can't get out of it.
I told you, doomed.
No! No!
All mankind, doomed.
No! We're falling right into it, into the heart.
Kind of a bummer. So, you know, in a way that the Chicken Heart story doesn't really fit the precise template, although it sort of does, because even in the Godzilla films, when they would, you know, in the first Godzilla film, they kill Godzilla, and yet they manage to keep bringing him back, and eventually these monsters are seen as these, you know, elemental forces that you just can't stop. You can't kill Godzilla, you can't kill the blob. But then you look back and if you look at the template of, you know, explorers find a mysterious beast, they think they've conquered it, they bring it back to civilization, in their pride they try to display it, but then the beast breaks free, and then they have to destroy it, and it's kind of man's hubris gone awry. Which is sort of the basis of those 50s monster movies. And then that's the story of King Kong. And before King Kong, Willis O'Brien made essentially the same movie in The Lost World, in which instead of bringing a giant gorilla back to New York, they bring a brontosaurus. And yes, I know there are some dinosaur purists, holier-than-thou snobs, who say there's no such thing as brontosaurus anymore. But I grew up saying brontosaurus. I'm going to keep saying brontosaurus. especially since in the movie it is a brontosaurus because the snobs hadn't decided to name it something else yet. In The Lost World, a scientist brings a brontosaurus back to London. It breaks free and wreaks havoc throughout the city, just like King Kong, except for some reason the brontosaurus doesn't, you know, climb to the top of Big Ben or something. That would have been funny, though. And so it makes me wonder if we can go back further. You know, that part of the storyline is not really existent in the book of The Lost World by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So did it start? Did that basic story template, that basic plot, start with The Lost World, where, you know, where there's specifically a giant creature that is discovered and then accidentally unleashed and has to be brought back under control, or they learn to their terror that they can't bring it back under control. And when I looked back at it, you know, I think maybe if you look at some of the old versions of the Golem story from, you know, what, the 1800s, the 1700s, where there are all kinds of variations of the Golem story of, you know, a rabbi who builds a giant man of clay and, you know, inscribes the magical letters on his forehead, or else, you know, inscribes them on a scroll that he puts in the golem's mouth. And at some point, he has to try to kill the golem again. But there are some versions of the story in which the golem grows large and you know, is used to defend the Jewish community, and then ends up growing large, and kind of his violence kind of goes out of control, and they have to try to kill him in order to bring him back under control again. So could the Golem story really be the origin of this? Or does it go back even further? I mean, you find stories of giant monsters in you know, the Greek myths and in other classical myths, the Celtic dragon myth, you know, in the Greek myths, the story of Bellerophon versus, you know, the Chimera or Chimera or however the hell you want to pronounce it. But the thing that those stories all have in common is that the monster has to be defeated by a mighty hero, and that's really what distinguishes the modern monster story, is that there is no mighty hero who faces off against the monster. The monster is so big that no one can really face him down, and they've either got to use scientific, you know, they've got to use the knowledge of mankind to find a scientific solution to the problem that may only be temporary, or else they just lose. Or else, in the later Godzilla films, you know, you use that monster to fight another monster. You know, you have the good monster on your side, and you got the bad monster on their side. I don't know. Anyway, it's worth thinking about. I'll be talking more about Cloverfield specifically right after this.
Let's turn during this brief intermission to a much more everyday situation, and a question that's much easier to answer. An angry girl is storming out of her friend's house. And her friend says,
"What can be wrong with Lucy these days? She crosses a bear and she's losing so much weight she looks terrible. She's just no fun anymore."
"Well, you know what that well-known nutrition authority says about how improper eating due to wartime living may cause a person to become deficient in vitamin B1 and iron, and how you absolutely need enough of them to keep your right weight and energy."
"Well, come to think of it, that was Ruth's trouble when she got so run down. So she took ionized yeast tablets. And you know how grand she looks and feels again now."
Yes, friends, any number of people who, due to vitamin B1 and iron shortage, were losing weight, losing strength and energy and interest in life, tell how ionized yeast tablets help them regain glorious pep and strength and needed pounds. So if you're short vitamin B1 and iron, don't wait. Go to your druggist this very night and say,
"A bottle of ionized yeast tablets, please."
Okay, so Cloverfield. When I describe it as Godzilla meets the Blair Witch Project, I'm not being flip. You know, it really, really is. It has the elements, well, some of the elements of a Godzilla film in the fact that there's a giant monster that comes from the sea. It attacks a capital city. It's enormous. You know, huge, beyond any modern creature. I mean, that's the thing that really distinguishes the Godzilla films from some of the other American-type films, is the sheer size of Godzilla. Godzilla's like 400 feet tall. This thing's like 1,000 feet tall, I think. It's just enormous, as opposed to, you know, King Kong, who was only, He varied between 30 and 40 feet tall, depending on what part of the movie it was. In the original King Kong, they varied his scale. He was featured as at a different scale in the jungle scenes as opposed to the city scenes. But Godzilla was huge, and in Cloverfield, the monster is huge. And then, you know, the army has to unleash just total hell. It's unlike King Kong, really. Although, in King Kong, they do use some of their most advanced weapons. They use airplanes, which had not been in use for very long. In the Godzilla films, they have to invent advanced scientific weapons. In this one, they never really say exactly what they're trying to use to destroy the monster. All we know is that, you know, they drop some really big bombs. We see some stealth fighters. We know they're using some really big bombs and some other stuff. So it's got that in common with the Godzilla film. But it's also got a lot in common with the Blair Witch Project, not just the fact that it's shot from a point of view. At the opening of the film, we're told that this is footage that they have found at a location. They found the camera with this footage in it, and they don't have any other explanation than that, which is essentially what happens in the Blair Witch Project at the beginning, right? They say that this was a camera that was found with, you know, they actually found a couple of cameras, and they've intercut the footage to make the story, but it's not a documentary, it's just found footage with a mysterious origin, presented without editorial comment. And that's exactly what Cloverfield is, to a large extent. Also, the Blair Witch Project was launched with an extensive viral marketing campaign before people really knew what viral marketing was, but it was launched with an extensive internet presence that built anticipation for the movie. And they've done the same thing with Cloverfield. There are several websites that expand on the world of Cloverfield and kind of give you some backstory on Cloverfield and some possible explanations of where the monster came from, or at least some teases about it. There are no hard and fast answers, just like there aren't any in the Blair Witch Project. And there are some surprisingly similar scenes. Of course, I guess with a point-of-view camera, there's always going to be some surprisingly similar scenes, but I mean, there's some real echoes, it seemed to me, sort of structurally, between Cloverfield and the Blair Witch Project. And of course, the biggest similarity in both of them is that they both gave me a headache. Something about that constantly moving camera where it never really frames the picture very well, and there's that sort of virtual motion without feeling any of the movement cues in your own head. I'm exactly the opposite of, you know, a friend of mine was telling me he gets sick in a car when he's riding in the back seat because he's not controlling the movement of the car. He can feel the movement, but he can't really see the movement, and he can't anticipate the movement or control it, and so it gives him a headache. What gives me a headache is kind of exactly the opposite, seeing the movement cues without feeling the movement cues. I got sick at the Blair Witch Project, not sick to my stomach, just kind of headachy and almost feverish. It was weird. And I got the exact same feeling at Cloverfield. And I felt the same way, strangely enough, when I was watching Black Hawk Down, which isn't as extreme, and it's not supposed to be, you know, a point-of-view film, but it does have a lot of the same kind of shaky camera work and kind of fast editing, and it's got this kind of grainy, overexposed look to a lot of it that it's, I don't know. I ended up feeling the same way. I wasn't necessarily sick or scared from the content. It was just the way that the film was made was just wreaking havoc with my brain. Something else that is interesting about Cloverfield is, on the one hand, it you know, pays homage to a lot of the cliches of the monster genre, but on the other hand, it subverts a lot of those cliches. It because we're so used to seeing them, we kind of anticipate them, and it just says, you know what, we're not going to have any scientists tell you where this monster came from. We're not going to invent some new weapon. You know, we're not going to have some researcher come up with a clever way to beat the monster. We're just going to, you know, show you these guys who have nothing to do with it. They don't know what it is. They're just running away from it. You know, we're not going to do a movie about a general. We're not going to do a movie about a scientist. We're going to do a movie about, you know, the people who are the extras who are screaming and running away, which is an interesting tack to take. I like that. Anyway. Hey, what? Oh, no. Oh, no. What's that? What's that? Shut the door on the cloning chamber. I accidentally hit the force grow button. The turductopus is getting bigger. Oh my gosh, it's about to break. It's gonna break out of the cloning chamber. It's gonna crush everything in this room unless I flush it out into the through the emergency venting system and shoot it out into the surface. Okay, let me do that. Emergency venting now. Let's turn on the view scope. Big turductopus, let me tell you. And I don't have, you know, I haven't built any of the stuff here in the secret lab, so I don't have any super weapons to fight it with. The professor's on vacation in Puerto Vallarta or someplace, or maybe Cucamonga, California, I don't know. But I don't have any super weapons to defeat this thing. The only thing I can do is, well, I guess I'll have to call in some help, because I am quite clearly out of my league, which, small plug for the story Out of His League appearing in Daikaiju 3 Giant Monsters vs. the World, written by me. well, okay. I swore I was never going to push this button again, but here we go. Alright, well, while my super friends take care of the turductopussy, I guess I'll go make some popcorn and watch the show on the ViewScope. I will see you next time. If you have any comments, questions, write to me at tonyfrasier62@cox.net, or you can leave a comment on my blog, frasersbrain.blogspot.com, and I will see you next time.